I'd like to just ask for hands. Yes, please, great. Straight
I was interested
away.
In the research that you've done in order to write these books. Obviously, you've covered a great many areas, so it must have taken a substantial amount of your time. Did you complete the research before you wrote the book? How long did you spend?
I think there are two kinds of research, in a way. There's the research you do initially, which gives you the basis and also the encouragement. Then there's a research that continues through the writing of the book, in amplifying details, checking on things, finding things that might make for more density or more apparent truth. But the initial process is very important. It's getting hold of. I mean, I live in rural Italy, and libraries are not thick on the ground there, really. So I rely a lot on the London Library, which is a subscription, private subscription library, and an excellent library. And they send me books and let me keep them for a long time. I've had a lot of. And at other times I've been, you know, very, very lucky in the circumstances. For the Sacred Hunger book, by merest chance, I went to Sweden for 6 months on a kind of visiting fellowship kind of scheme through the Arts Council, and I was at the University of Lund in the south of Sweden, and they had a wonderful library there in English, a lot of books in English, and I found books about seafaring and 18th century nautical glossaries, and even a kind of logbook written by a slaving skipper in the 1750s, which things you couldn't dream of. And so I came back to Helsinki, where I was living then, with a sheaf of stuff, and was able to get on there quite well, and that was lucky. But it's always a difficulty and always a necessity, and it's always a pleasure. In fact, often enough, I would go on researching the thing forever, and I would never get going because I like it. You know? And I found I was good at it. I found I was quite good at research, which I didn't suspect, because I've never been very gifted academically. I found that I had a sense of the past, which is rather difficult to define, but which does exist, and many people are without it. A feeling for modes of thought and styles of speech and the sort of culture of that period. And I found that I had quite a fascination with digging up the things and using them. And of course, it's not like any other sort of reading. It's exciting because you know all the time that you're reading on the verge of some discovery. So it's a special kind of thing. And if ever I stop writing novels, which I might be obliged to do sooner or later, because the pen will fall from my, you know, palsied clutch, then I think I will miss, more than the writing of the novels, I think I'll miss that quality of researching, knowing or hoping to find something that you can use.
Another. Thank you.
Well, I've got several, really, but I just asked this one. Talking about the research and you know, dealing with the past, and my favourite of your books is Morality Play, and rereading that recently, I'm just struck by the way the people speak. I mean, you know, it's incredible. You kind of allow people to, you know, suspend their disbelief in a way, and I just think that's an incredible skill to possess. Do you have to really work hard at it? Because obviously they didn't speak like that then, did they,
no,
anymore?
They
than, you know.
No, they didn't. In that period, that's a Morality Play,
yes.
Sort of 14th century,
yes.
Isn't it? I think if I try to write the dialogue of the 14th century, people would get fed up with it in no time, and I wouldn't be able to do it. So it's a sort of compromise between, you know, what really, mainly, it's the avoidance of obvious anachronism in styles of speech. It's a certain kind of formalism, a care not to use. I mean, you know, I it's difficult to find examples, but there was a screen, morality play was made into a film under a different title. It was called The Reckoning. It was a pretty awful film. It was really pretty terrible. But when I saw the screenplay for it, the man who'd written the screenplay really didn't have any sense of the sort of things people might say or might behave in that period. When the priest said he'd committed adultery, he'd been guilty of adultery and he'd suffered from it and suffered in his conscience. One of the characters in the screenplay said, "Oh, I thought that went with the job." You know, I mean.
Yes.
To avoid that kind of monstrous anachronism is half the battle, more than half.
Is it something that comes fairly easily to you?
Yes, it is. Once I get hold of a voice.
Yes.
You know, it takes a little while. This is in the first person, so it's Nicholas, isn't it, who is telling the story.
Yes.
And it takes me a while to get hold of him and to get hold of his particular idiom, but once that is done, I go along fairly smoothly then.
Stone Virgin had three
different periods of time. Yes, Venice in the 15th century. Yes, Venice in the 15th century. And in the 18th century, and in the 1960s, it was always Venice, but it was in three different periods with three different narrators. Mm. Yeah, that caused me quite a few headaches.
I can remember.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Are there novelists that have especially influenced you? I've just started reading The Moonstone again and I suddenly struck the beginning of The Moonstone and your
yes, I think Moonstone's a wonderful novel. I'm not aware of direct influence, but there is so much that's absorbed and wasn't aware of it, and they're sort of not, you know, you're not conscious, but I think influence is a very complicated thing. Those that I know about and the early influences, the very first, was American fiction of the Deep South. And this was, I was about sort of 20. Eudora Welty, Carson McCullers, Catherine Ann Porter, to some extent Faulkner, but less so. I thought they were all terrific, you know, and especially Eudora Welty. I just thought she was just, and I still do. And I wanted to write like that, but I wanted to be in the company of writers. And I think it was one of the first things I found, not to be as good as she is, but simply to be, as it were, in the same crowd. Maybe it's not on the fringes, but in the same kind of crowd. And this is what you really call a literary influence. It's not just a direct borrowing of style. It's a sense of an affinity that you want to demonstrate, really. But I was living in Stockton-on-Tees at the time, and that's a long way from Mississippi, and the stories that I wrote were a very uneasy mixture of, you know, Stockton-on-Tees and Mississippi, and they didn't work, as you can imagine, and so they were all rejected with monotonous regularity. And that went on. It took me a long time to understand that I wasn't writing the right kind of story. I wrote the right kind of fiction. But that's then later it was Joseph Conrad and Graham Greene also and William Golding. Those are the people I admire. And I think have somehow changed the way in some way I can't easily define of how I want to write. But I think that at some point one finds a voice of one's own and one does things that one feels to be entirely, I don't think one is ever entirely original, but I feel that most of the later books have come from myself, and that I actually feel, which is a rather boastful thing to say, I feel that they could not have been written by anybody else. And that's to me a sense of originality. And I could easily be wrong in that. I mean, it's just another illusion. But I like to think of it that way.
wanted to ask you about, you talked a lot about your historical research, but just on the matter of illusion, your interest in ideas as well. For example, the notion of paradise and utopia, or the relationship between that and man's love of illusions, and how we come to terms with the loss of them, or find some way to kind of continue something maybe more realistic out of it. So, which I thought you did beautifully in Sacred Hunger, as an idea that you were sort of working out. And so just wanted to ask you a bit about that really, and your interest in...
Well, I was interested in it, and of course the 18th century was a time of belief in utopias and man as man as being capable of goodness, if only the coercions of authority and the taint of trade, etc., were removed. That was a fairly common philosophical belief, I believe, in that mid-18th century. So it was okay, it was all right historically to do it, to put that in, but it wasn't just that. It was a real interest that I had in, exactly as you've expressed it there, and I couldn't put it better, this discrepancy or this relationship between the ideal world, the world, you know, and what we manage stumblingly and to actually achieve, and the best we can do, and how far... And I remember when I was writing the novel, I was still living in Finland then, and I remember the end, trying to write the end, and endings are very committing. I mean, beginnings are, I think, much easier, but in the end, the resolution, the end contains the meaning, and you declare yourself. The writer declares himself in the ending, more than anywhere else. And so endings are important and difficult. And I didn't know until the last moment, almost, whether to make my experiment, to make their experiment of utopia in the wilds of Florida, to build a community there that of black man and white man together, of escaped slave and escaped slaver, as it were, all forced together in proximity and having to make a community. And being free to make that community without external pressure, whether that could work, since they were all people that had the print of slavery on them, whether that could work. And the degree to which you think it could work, or even the degree to which you think it's worth trying, marks how far you have faith in human capacities for improvement or for, you know, and that is a difficult thing. It's the old problem of the store of the bottle. Well, you know, it's either half empty or half full. In a sense, you know, you've got two ways of looking at it. But in the end of the book, I don't know if you remember, when Paris is dying, and he shouts, I've forgotten the precise words. It wasn't useless. It wasn't a failure. He's saying something about. Not just about that utopia and that failed utopia, but about our capacity for believing in the possibility of it, and that is where the strength, that is where the human strength should be, if it is there. That this, inveterate trying again sort of thing.
Some more questions? Yes, please.
When you were young and first writing, did you try or consider writing from your own experience and background, or did that never feel right for you?
No, it never really did, because my early stories, which weren't very good and which, as I say, were rejected, were still attempts at something that was in a certain way exotic and... in a certain way fabulous, or an attempt at fable is a very difficult form, and I was really not up to it, but there was always that tendency, I think. Then later on, I mean, I abandoned short stories because I had so much disappointment with them, and I I was fortunate to meet, I showed my stories to a man, and he was a visiting professor at Oxford, a Greek, he read them, and he said he thought there was talent there. And then he looked at me and he said, "My advice to you," he said, and it's printed on one of my, "try the longer form." Try the longer form. And I've never forgotten that. It was excellent advice, because I actually turned out to be much better at the longer form, because you can be digressive, you can go roundabout, you can tie themes together, you've got more scope. And I was just better at doing that. And I was never rejected again. I mean, once I started writing novels, I never had any more rejection slips. I never made any money, but I didn't have any rejection slips. And even my first novel was set exotically for me, because I was from provincial Britain, and I went to live in Cornwall. And for me at that time, Cornwall was a sort of mecca. It was as near as you could get to being abroad. And there were kind of a rather strange and a kind of cosmopolitan society there, a mixture of people, which I thought fascinating. So I sort of, you know, wrote about that. Then went to Greece and wrote about Athens, and so it went on. And always writing about a place when I was in another place. That was the other feature. When I wrote about Athens, I was already in Turkey. And when I wrote about Turkey, I was already in sort of, I don't know where, Wimbledon, London, I think it was.
What about poetry? Did you ever?
Poetry? No, I never did. No, thank God, no, I didn't do that. No, I didn't. I didn't ever try to write poetry. I don't know why. I just probably didn't think I'd be any good. Didn't think I'd be any good at it. There's a degree of poetry in prose that is well cadenced and done. I felt happier with that.
Yes,
again.
Yep.
Do you have a favourite amongst your novels?
A favourite?
Yes.
No, not really. Not really. I think some of them, I mean, some of them mark periods of life in which are, stand out in my mind as being moments of change, times of change or new direction. I wrote a novel called Mooncranker's Gift. It was my fourth novel. It's not out of print exactly, but it's not much read these days. You know, when I wrote that novel, I got an offer from Penguin Paperbacks to do it, and at the same time, in the same week, I got an offer from, I think it was Houghton Mifflin in the United States. So in 1 week, for the first time, after my fourth novel, I'm paperback and Penguin paperback, and in hardback in the United States. And I remember when I heard the news about the American thing, I remember that, you know, I went to a party, not to celebrate that, but I was going anyway. I was going to a party, and I remember that sort of euphoria as I drank quite a lot at the party, naturally. But I remember a euphoria, the sense of, well, I've made it. This is it, you know. I'm. What more could one want? And it never made the slightest difference to anything, really. In the end, I just went on in the same way. I was still quite fairly penurious, but I was out in paperback, and I was published in the States, and so it was a step forward. But it doesn't make the novel any particular. It's only the moment. I don't like any of my novels until they're in the past. I don't like them as I write them, much at all. I need some degree of affirmation and approval, usually, in order to start believing in them. Then.
Yes.
Are you seeking some kind of perfection? Are there elements of your previous novels that you felt dissatisfied with that I want to do differently or better, or do you ever feel that, you know, you've got to write another one because it might be the best? Or
yes, I think I do. Sometimes in the past I've done creative writing courses and taught at university departments people who want to. Quite often, in fact, I've done that over the years because it was a way of making a living earlier on, or a way of helping with the income. And people used to ask me for advice sometimes, what key piece of advice I could give to the budding writers, or someone who wanted to. And it was a difficult thing, but I would say that the most important thing is to try to understand yourself, and try to in a way to. Try to go into a sort of self-communion so that you look at yourself and decide somehow, even if it's roughly and approximately, what kind of thing you might be good at doing, and try to do that. Not because it's fashionable, not because you think it might do well, or that it's a literary mode that it would be likely to succeed or make, but only what you think it lies within your talent. I know it's difficult. It's easy to say, but it's not. But I think it's important, and I think that one does that. One always tries to realize something that is consonant with one's own capacity, and we all have different capacities, and we're all good at different things. I mean, no novelist ever born is good at everything. So it's a question of trying to do justice, me in my minor way, with the talent that I have, and with the things I can really do well. And maybe you can make mistakes. You know, you can. If you make mistakes, you can use a lot of time barking up the wrong tree, really.
Okay. Yes, please.
That fascinates me because it seems one thing that. Your book seems to veer from the big, both in the sense of lots of pages, but big stories, big themes, to much
smaller.
Hmm. And I've forgotten the title, the chap who's obsessed with Nelson.
The what?
The one about the guy who's obsessed with Nelson.
Oh, Losing Nelson, yes.
Losing Nelson. Which is, I mean, okay, Nelson is very big, but the story is about...
Yeah, it's just a story of obsession. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Huge range. So say that you do what you're best at. You seem to be best at an awful lot.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'd like to believe that. My gosh, yes, I would. a lot of things are accident. I mean, as well. I mean, the Sacred Hunger only came about through my going to Liverpool, in the first place. I went to Liverpool as writer in residence at the University of Liverpool. Which was the great slave trading port. If I hadn't gone to Liverpool, I don't think I would have ever written that book, because I wouldn't have had the stimulus, you know, because the evidence of slavery was everywhere in the city, still is. And with Losing Nelson, I was originally invited to write a biography of Nelson, because after writing The Sacred Hunger and The Slave Ship, everyone thought for a while that I was knew all about slave ships and all about ships, all about sailing ships, which is ridiculous. I don't know anything about them. I mean, I don't know the back from the front, really. I couldn't do the biography. I didn't feel competent to do it. And I was living in Italy then, and you know, as I said, research facility. So I turned it around into a novel, and that's how it came about. That because the research I'd done, which convinced me that I wasn't going to be able to do a biography, then could be incorporated in the novel. So it's sort of an accidental process. And then in order for the novel to contain a biography of Nelson, I had to have an obsessive biographer. And so it came about. And then I had to think of how to deal with the battles, because I couldn't describe them straight from the history book. So I gave him a billiard table on which to play with model ships and so on. So, you know, one thing led to another. I don't know if that answers your question very well, but it is true anyway that they do range from a large scale with a lot of characters and a broad canvas to a fairly small focus. And, yeah.
Do they alternate? I haven't looked at the.
No, I don't. No, well, I haven't looked. the book I'm doing now has got, which is the successor of this, has got a much wider field, because because Thorstein only speaks in his voice, and so nothing happens that he doesn't know about. Whereas in the new one, I've got different people who have the different centres of consciousness, as you would call it, different narrating points of view, and. Of course, you get more inclusiveness, but you also run the risk of fragmentation that way. So,
another question? Oh. Yes, please.
Just following up on the losing Nelson, you showed us a very different side of Nelson, something I didn't know about at all, the cruelty, the treachery. Were you saying something about the blindness of jingoism in there?
I think yes. I think I was. I think I mean because I grew up at school. Nelson was a great hero for us, as he probably is still for British schoolboys. He was portrayed as a hero. He was portrayed as faultless, really, and in many ways, of course, he was a great hero. And he died at the moment of triumph, which gives him a particular a martyr. An aura of martyrdom as well. So I had this feeling, but at the same time, looking at his life, I could see that there were elements that weren't heroic. He was extremely vain, for example. He had irrational prejudices especially against the French. I mean, his mother died when he was 9 years old, but his mother, almost with her milk, gave him a hatred of the French, because she loathed the French too. In fact, people did hate the French. I wonder if things have changed much. I don't know. But you must treat. He said always, you must treat a Frenchman as if he were the devil. That was his favorite expression. You must treat a Frenchman as if he were the devil, and these kind of things that were useful in combat, but don't really stand up very well to a rational view of it. And then his treatment of his wife wasn't really terribly laudable, and so on and so forth. And in many ways, it struck me as a man very brave, but really brave, because an officer on the quarterdeck of those ships in action, they couldn't do anything, just had to walk around looking smart and nonchalant while people dying all around them, And the breakdown rate and the suicide rate in naval officers at the time was very high. It was a strain. I mean, he was just, it was as if he were walking on the decks, he was having a walk in the park on a summer morning, and he was wonderful with his buckled shoes and his cane and his tricorn hat and so on. Brave and prompt in action and decision, amazingly so, but in many other ways an ordinary man. And this discrepancy always was there in my mind as I wrote the book, and the conflict in myself from the transition from sort of heroism to this qualified sort of opinion, a much more complex. And then there was the business in Naples in 1798, where the Neapolitan Republicans were betrayed, and the general opinion is that Nelson had a hand in that, but he made promises which were then not fulfilled, and he generally felt that he brought them out to their deaths. So this was, for my narrator, a tremendous stumbling block in his intense desire to worship Nelson. And he does everything he can to deny this episode and to find a better interpretation for it. And it's in this stress that his mind deteriorates in the end, and he becomes what he does become. So... an extraordinary figure. And the other thing about him was he could make himself loved. He was loved by his crew and by the people. He had a great charisma. He had what we now call charisma, Now, I don't think that was an 18th century word, but or 19th century. But yeah, there's a mixture. Interesting. And I don't know if you've read the book, but the woman to whom he's dictating, who's called Miss Lily, is a very she's sort of very common sense person who doesn't sort of overestimate the heroic element, but has a much more, you might call, belittling view, but a more sensible view. So in between these two, that same conflict is played out. And because he's partly falling in love with her as well, and she, you know, she just says, well, you know, once why she said, well, he said Nelson was really just a serial killer, really, wasn't he? Well, serial killer. Well, she said, yeah, well, everywhere he went, a lot of people got killed, and so that represents one way of looking at heroism, and one way of looking at imperial power as well, and at the British naval achievement, which was enormous, of course, and the Battle of Trafalgar secured the seas for Britain for a century, really. Undisputed sway of the seas for a century, quite something.
Thank you. I'm going to wind it up there. That was quite something. I've just been thinking about that review I mentioned right at the start. Another thing it omitted was the wisdom of the book. And I think that word, wisdom, seems to be very much at the forefront of my mind about the author as well. And I think we've witnessed a tremendous amount of wisdom tonight. And I think we've been privileged to do that. So I'd like to thank Barry very much and thank Ken for prompting those thoughts in the initial part of the evening, and to thank you for your questions, which have brought out even more of those incredibly wise words. Thank you very much to both of you.